Hey, as we approach the 150th anniversary of the Great Chicago Fire, it's a story that's very familiar to all of us, anybody connected to this city. Reading from Chicago Magazine's account here, by 1870, Chicago was the United States' fifth largest city with a population of 300,000. And for the most part, it was made of wood. Nearly the entire fire department spent the night of Saturday, October 7th, battling a blaze that burned down four square blocks just west of Chicago River. They barely had a chance to rest when another fire broke out Sunday night, half mile south. After that, firefighter Leo Myers recalled, everything went wrong. And over the next 30 hours, that fire would grow and grow, roaring across roughly three square miles in the heart of Chicago, killing hundreds of people, destroying 17,000 buildings, causing more property damage than any fire before it in America. So here we are at the 150th anniversary. Writer Robert Lorzel penned a fascinating piece in Chicago Magazine. That's the intro, but what is truly fascinating about this piece, and I couldn't stop reading it as soon as I started, Robert, it's really amazing, is you went through the archives, I guess, and you found the actual words of the people who lived through it. Really fascinating.
Yeah. The focus that that I wanted for this article and my editors at Chicago Magazine wanted was to present the story as much as possible, just in the words of people who were there at the time.
Yeah, and you do, it's people, regular folks, there are some officials, there are people who are first responders, there is Mrs. O'Leary herself and her family, kind of hopefully vindicating themselves finally, cleaning that up, that piece of history for the folks who still believe they had part of it to do something to do with it. Tell that story first, I want to get into some of the others.
Yeah, well, just about all the evidence we have from testimony from the O'Leary family themselves and their neighbors is that they were in bed when the fire started. So this myth rose up pretty quickly. I mean, within hours of the fire starting, we've got one witness who was there in the crowds watching the fire who remembers that the kids on the street were saying that Mrs. O'Leary's cow had kicked over the lantern and started the fire. So this is, you know, this very well could have just been the stories that kids were telling on the streets. But before you knew it, it was in newspapers, and it really became the famous story that we all know today, 150 years later. But it's pretty clear that Catherine O'Leary was not in the barn when the fire started. And there are various stories that were told over the years about exactly how the fire might have started in the barn, we really don't know. There are a lot of competing theories about it. But I think we can vindicate Mrs. O'Leary and the rest of her family that it may have started in their barn. And, you know, maybe the cow did kick over a lantern or something.
Right.
But she wasn't there.
She wasn't there. And I see, is that Katie O'Leary? Is that Mrs. O'Leary? Because
well,
there are several
Catherine O'Leary's. was how her name was spelled out, but her husband called her Kate. So I think Kate was probably, the nickname that was used in the family. And one of the people I quote in the story is her daughter, Katie, who was a young girl at the time, but did speak many years later with the Chicago Tribune about what had happened.
Yeah, you have quotes here, but Catherine O'Leary, my husband got outside the door and he ran back to the bedroom and said, Kate, the barn is on fire. Patrick O'Leary, I put the children in the street as fast as I could. The fire was lighting so strong when I got up. And you tell the tales of all the folks trying to escape the horrible fire that had just succumbed the city or just taken hold of everything, it seemed.
Yeah.
How did you find out, Robert, this had to be just incredibly tedious to look up all of these quotes and these accounts, and they're just they're fascinating when you read them.
Yeah, well, tedious but also fascinating. I mean, I like doing these projects where seriously, I mean, this is a pretty long article as far as magazine articles go. It's about 12,000 words, but the amount of material that I went through to get these 12,000 words was many times that. There are some great old letters and diary sorts of journals sitting in the archives over at the Chicago History Museum, which was very helpful. Some of those have been printed before. I think, I'm not the first historian to go through those files, but but I think I did find some little nuggets of information about the people who wrote those letters that brought them to life in a new way, I hope.
Like what? The ones that you hadn't seen somewhere else? Because a lot of this was new to me as I read through it.
Yeah, well, there are just people like, for example, there's this woman named Adele Moore, who tells a story about fleeing from her home on the north side with her husband and some neighbors, and they ended up on the area that everyone called the Sands, which was the lakefront north of the river. There were basically a bunch of people there trying to shelter by the water while everything around them was on fire, but they ended up in this horrific situation where not only were they surrounded by fire, but the wind was blowing hot sand at them, and some of them may have even drowned because they're going into the water. And so her story is sitting there at the Chicago History Museum, but all it says is Del Moore, and it didn't have any information about who was Del Moore. And so I had to go online to places like Ancestry.com, and, you know, they took a number of steps just to figure out, you know, who is this woman, exactly where did she live, and I think that kind of helped put that story in better context than if it's just sitting there as this, you know, handwritten document, and you're wondering, well, who wrote this, and what's it all about?
Right. Amazing. That's one of my favorite museums, the Chicago History Museum. There's so much there, little nuggets that you can find, but you certainly put pieces together. One of the things you point out here, and you have the firsthand accounts, there's a Western Union telegraph operator, 19 at the time, who was one of the many that spoke out about how the city felt when the waterworks were on fire, that they'd seen the courthouse burn, they'd seen churches burn, they saw so many major monuments and important structures across the city come down, but it was all of a sudden that they realized their danger when they saw the waterworks were burning.
Right. And that's the building that you can still see today, because the building, you know, the exterior walls of it survived, and we've got the famous water tower, which is across the street from it on Michigan Avenue, and the waterworks building where Looking Glass Theater now is located. But on the night of the fire, you know, the fire had been spreading through downtown. Some cinders are blowing across the river to the north side, and the waterworks, basically the roof of it, catches on fire. And around 3 a.m. on October 9th, the waterworks stopped pumping water out. So at that point, the hydrants started going dry around the city. So the firefighters really had no way of even getting water to spray on buildings unless they could get it straight out of the river or the lake at that point. So, like as you mentioned, the telegraph operator was one of the people who was nearby and saw the waterworks burning. And that was sort of the moment at which people, you know, you might have already thought by that point the city is pretty much doomed and so much of it is just going to burn down. But when people saw that there's not going to be any water in their faucets or out of hydrants, I think despair was the mood that struck everyone at that moment. And they knew they had to run as fast as they could to get out of there.
And yet it seems you also tell the tale of how the city must be rebuilt. It just sort of became that big deal right away. Everyone knew that that's what they must do, and you have lots of accounts of that, of the Chicago spirit, which are just beautiful. Amazing that people could think that way at that time, to turn their, you know, turn their feelings to hope.
Right, and there are many stories about that, how the rebuilding started almost immediately, as soon as they could clear debris away and start building again. A lot of people, I think some of those initial temporary buildings that went up would probably be sort of like, you know, like a ramshackle little outpost where someone's going to start selling stuff in the middle of the burned area of downtown Chicago. But there were people doing that. And before you knew it, a lot of tall buildings were going back up again.
Yeah. You said no newspapers were published in Chicago the morning of Monday, October 9th. The fire had destroyed all the downtown newspaper offices, so there weren't really newspaper accounts from the day after, maybe in the days to come. So a lot of this came from what, like you said, letters and other kinds of things that made it?
Yeah, and there are one thing that's fascinating, and this is one of the many things I did not really have space to include in my story. But if you look in other newspapers around the country, there are reports that the AP was sending, the Associated Press, from the telegraph office in downtown Chicago. So there are dispatches at like 11:30 and midnight and so forth up until about 1:45 a.m., I think it is, on that Monday morning when the AP sends a telegraph dispatch from downtown Chicago that ends with them saying that the telegraph office is on fire and the reporter and telegraph operator are fleeing the building, and then, you know, all communication gets cut off to other newspapers until the telegraph operators set up a temporary office somewhere else. But you can see those dramatic accounts appearing in newspapers around the country. Ironically, people in Chicago had no access to that in that age. You know, you can imagine today that people would be on Twitter or the Internet watching all this stuff as it's happening at that moment. But back then, communication was a lot different. The telegraph was connecting people. But in this case, people in Chicago may have known less about exactly what was going on than someone in, say, New York.
For sure. Well, you did an amazing job just linking the firsthand accounts together. The people, their stories just leap from the page. I could not find myself pulling away from it. I recommend it to anyone who can get your hands on Chicago Magazine. I can't help but ask, Robert, I mean, this should be like a Netflix series or something, the way the stuff that you put together here. I don't know if you have plans for that, but it could be.
I don't exactly, but sure.
You never know. You never know. Thank you, Robert, for the time. Enjoy your Wednesday.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Have a good day.
Great conversation, I thought, with Robert Lorzel. His piece, you've got to read it. It's about the Great Chicago Fire. Never heard the story told quite that way, and I've read a number of stories about the Great Chicago Fire, as you have too. But Larry wants to point something out. Go ahead, Larry. You're on WGN.
Good afternoon, Anna. I enjoy listening to you and your show.
Thank you, Larry.
We were in Wisconsin about 40 years ago, and we stopped at a town called Peshtigo, Wisconsin, and went to a fire museum at that little town. And we learned that on the same day as the Chicago fire, there was a forest fire at Peshtigo, Wisconsin, and between 1,500 and 2,000 people perished in that fire, many of them saving themselves by diving into a river, and I'm not sure what river it is, period. Interestingly enough, I heard about this again 30 years later when Paul Harvey was still alive. He did a rest of the story bit on that, in which he talked about the Chicago fire, and then he talked about the Peshtigo fire. I just thought I'd throw that in since you were talking about the Chicago fire.
I'll have to look that up, that Paul Harvey piece. I have not heard that. He does mention Robert Lorzel in the Chicago Magazine piece about that fire that was going on at the time. I think he described Peshtigo as a lumber town in the article he wrote.
Yeah, it was a lumber town, and I don't remember what happened that caused the fire, but I remember seeing drawings of people jumping into the river to try to save themselves. So I just found it interesting that you were talking about it today.
It is.
And thought I'd throw that in.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for the call, and I appreciate you listening. And yeah, he does mention it. He said that more people died in that fire at the time. It was not as built up a city, certainly, or as populous a city, but more people died in that fire in Peshtigo, Wisconsin.